Hi there, I'm Dexter Fergie, and you're listening to New Books in the History of the Social Sciences. Thank you very much for listening and for supporting our work at the New Books Network. Today I have the fortune of speaking with Orr Rosenboim about her terrific new book, Emergence of Globalism, Visions of World Order in Britain and the United States, 1939 to 1950. It was published this year by Princeton University Press. Rosenboim is a junior research fellow at the University of Cambridge. Her book is a welcome contribution to the intellectual history of international thought. Rather than looking at the disciplinary history of IR, Rosenboim traces the thinking of an eclectic array of public intellectuals in the middle of the 20th century, from Nicholas Spykman to Owen Lattimore, from H.G. Wells to Friedrich Hayek. Though disparate in their political leanings, all of these intellectuals perceived the world to be in crisis and thought up global solutions to address the crisis. These individuals were historically significant, she argues, because we have inherited their categories. In other words, we see the world through their concepts. My background is in both IR and history, so the book really spoke to me, but it would also be of great interest to anyone studying international history, intellectual history, political science, and really anyone wanting to critically reflect on the language we use in our discussions of global politics. I hope you enjoy the interview as much as I did. I'm here with Orr Rosenboim to discuss her new book, The Emergence of Globalism, Visions of World Order in Britain and the United States, 1939 to 1950. Welcome to the show, Orr, and the book was a real pleasure to read.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Absolutely. To start off the show, can you tell listeners what brought you to history and specifically to intellectual history?
Yes, so this has been a long trip for me that started in Bologna in Italy, where I did my undergrads. It was a course in contemporary history, which focused on the 20th century. And I was really gripped by the course in the history of political thought by the Italian philosopher Carlo Galli. And he introduced me to that field. And then I started off thinking about cosmopolitanism. It was back in 2009, so just before the crisis of migrants became important in Italy. But the themes that concerned me were already related to these topics. Then I moved to Oxford and started working on the history of empire and started thinking more concretely about how in the 20th century ideas about cosmopolitanism and imperialism were interconnected. And I worked a lot on the interwar period, which in British history provides a fertile ground for thinking about internationalism and the, let's say, decline of the British Empire. So this was the intellectual trajectory that brought me eventually to the book project that started off as my PhD thesis. So I was really interested in intellectual history because it seemed to me that in contemporary political discourse, we use a lot of categories, but we're not necessarily aware of their full meaning. And so I think intellectual historians can help us understand the genealogy of the terms that we use so frequently.
Excellent. Thank you for that. To begin, the book is an intellectual history of globalism. It sets out to tell the story of how several American, British, and emigre scholars from 1939 to 1950 experience a crisis in the world order and obsessed with theorizing and pursuing alternatives. Globalism did not, as you write, did not signify the abandonment of all other constituent elements of politics, states, empires, federations, non-state communities, and supranational organizations were reimagined and redefined, but not necessarily abolished, before they could acquire a new place in the modern global world. So you write that one objective of the book is to outline the competing meanings of the global as a political space in mid-century thought. For the people that you follow, the global political space was both geographic and conceptual. So can you just tell listeners a little bit about what you envisioned when you were writing this book? And also, what was the process, because this was originally a PhD thesis, what was the process of turning it into a book like?
Yes, so First of all, my project started in the archives. So I looked at thinkers who, during the 1940s, were thinking about world order. And what I discovered was that many of them referred to the global space of politics, if you want, or the world as a whole, as a united kind of planetary space, as the relevant measurement of politics after the war. And so a lot of them were thinking about how to adapt politics to this new conception that defined life in the 1940s for them. So they were thinking a lot about interconnectedness, about technology, about communication, and all of these factors created for them this condition of the global and the rise of the global space. And so, as you said, I was interested in understanding the relations between this geographical conception of the globe and its political and conceptual implications. And what I discovered is that in the 40s, there was this rising concern with trying to provide a political response to this condition of the global, to this condition of globalism that today maybe some of us would call globalization. But what was important for them was really finding the political response to that. So it wasn't really just an economic or technological phenomenon. And so this was really the initial concern that I, or interest that I had. I was curious to see the political responses that they found to this perception of globalism that was so important for them. And it resonated in a sense with concerns that I felt we have in our world today. However, we often talk about globalism and globalization in a financial or economic or technological sense and not really in a political sense. And then afterwards, this became my PhD thesis, which focused around a series of conversations that these intellectuals had between them about different aspects of this global political condition. So they attacked this problem from various points of view. So, for example, from the point of view of the nation state, or from the point of view of geopolitics and empire, or from themes around economics and federalism, or from a religious viewpoint. And so all of these perceptions seem to me to offer, as you said, the competing visions of globalism. And this, the PhD project was completed in 2014. And so afterwards, I spent the last few years transforming it into a book, which is a slightly different project, as you may know, because the book is really aiming at reaching out to audience beyond academia and to trying to address questions that are important not only for scholars, but also for people out there, members of the public concerned with world politics today as well, and with the genealogy of the concepts that we use for understanding politics now.
Perfect. Thank you for that answer. Your book offers a really interesting periodization. So you tell the story of these conversations about globalism that take place between 1939 and 1950. And you don't break up the narrative that much between the Second World War and the beginning of the Cold War, or the dropping of the first atomic bomb. So can you say something a little bit about your timeline, and specifically, why did globalism emerge in this period?
Yes. So I decided to present the decade of the 40s as a coherent, or at least a period that was characterized by a certain mode of thinking. And I don't really use 45 as a decisive breaking point, because a lot of the thinkers that I looked at considered the dropping of the atomic bomb as an enhancement of their previous ideas rather than a decisive turning point. So for them, the atomic bomb just rendered their previous concern more urgent. But it didn't necessarily create a whole new set of ideas that had to be addressed. And so I think that by presenting the decade as a longer period in which ideas evolved and developed makes more sense of the way that ideas about world order were really shaped in the 40s. Because we need to remember that from 1940, Americans were already concerned with planning the recovery of Europe, planning world order, and redefining the U.S. place in it. So these things were not really a post-war matters. These were concerns that were already relevant for the Americans and also for the British during the war. And so the wartime was already a period of very intense theorizing and thinking about what would happen after the war. And as for the end of this period, today when we look backwards, it's easy to see that really soon after the end of the war, the origins of the Cold War started to appear. And many hopes that were perhaps for collaboration between the U.S. and Russia were not given any concrete historical realization. However, when people lived the 40s, they didn't necessarily see that. Some of them, very few of them, actually foresaw the Cold War as it happened. And one of them is Raymond Aron. But many of the others were, in a way, taken by the Cold War by surprise. So it was not for them an inevitable outcome of the decade. And so I really put the end of that story of the window of opportunity of the globalism as a way of thinking about world affairs in 1950, because it was the Korean War that for many signified the end of that opportunity to change. So some of them also saw, for example, the 1947 coup in Czechoslovakia as a decisive moment, but these things were a bit more flexible. And so I think that by thinking about the 40s as a long decade in which the Second World War was just one major event, but it did not necessarily condition all of the theorizing that happened, makes more sense of what really was going on then.
Perfect. Can you say a little bit more about why the Korean War signified a closing of alternatives to the Cold War?
I think that for many people who are based in the U.S., a bit less so for the British, but for the Americans and the emigres who were there, the Korean War signified a resumed aggressive militant campaign in which the U.S. and Russia were on the opposite sides. And so after the wartime alliance between Russia and Soviet Russia and the U.S., this was really the first time that formally the U.S. and Soviet Union were on opposite sides. And so this really meant, I think, that the opposition between these two great powers was not only diplomatic or ideological, but it could also have a military aspect. And in that sense, this brought an end to any thoughts about political cooperation between them in the context of globalist plannings of world order. So I think this was the concreteness of violence really brought an end to these ideas.
Okay, so we'll dive into the book now, and the book is the book's chapters are extremely rich and filled with many really interesting points and sub-arguments. So I'm not certain we'll cover absolutely everything, but we'll give it a go. So in chapter 2, called "Reimagining the State in a Global Space," you follow three different intellectuals: Raymond Aron, David Mitrani, and E.H. Carr, as each of them identified novel aspects of the world system that fundamentally changed the power and utility of the nation state. Can you say a little bit about these intellectuals, what their critiques of the nation state were, and what they saw as an alternative?
So I chose these three because all of them were concerned with what would be the future of the nation state in the global era, but they were not necessarily in favor of the abolition of the state. And so they were not federalists in that sense, where they did not envisage an order in which the states would be replaced by completely different political unity. And so I was interested in seeing how each of them imagined the future of the state that would have to be remeasured and redefined according to these conditions that were set by the new rise of globalism. And I think Raymond Aron is an evident he's a great example of thinking about the state and having serious doubts about what kind of future France could have beyond its own borders. Because one of the main ideas that Aron developed in his stay in London during the war, because he had to leave France after the armistice, he developed this understanding that France could not really think of its future as a nation state without considering the global implications of its political existence. And so he developed various strategies for addressing this problem. And in this sense, he's a bit difficult to pin down, because at a certain point, he thought that France should reinforce its European connections. On another set of articles, he advocated for closer Atlantic connections with the United States. In a different angle, he thought that France should be closer to Germany, rather than to all of Europe. And so there are these various attempts to think about France. But what really matters for me is the use he makes of the idea of political myth. And so he tries to create this bridge between the nation state and the global sphere of politics, using the idea of the myth as a way to educate and to share with people the political obligations that they have in the state. And so he suggested that, similarly as France imagined itself as created a myth of a nation state, it should create a similar myth to imagine itself within a European community. And this myth is like political storytelling. It's the way that France is presented to its citizens and to the world as a whole. And I think this is really interesting nowadays also, when we see states trying to present themselves to the world as a certain, not really as in through an ideology, but through a certain conception of what the state is standing for. What are the real values that are trying to be advanced in that system? And this stands in concrete opposition to the way that David Mitterrani imagined the state in the global order. So for him, the idea of a myth is too much connected to the dangerous political ideologies that brought about the Second World War. And so his career basically was oriented towards the attempt to find a way to save the state, but also prevent ideologies from degenerating into war. And nationalism was for him one of these dangerous ideologies. And so he set up a completely different solution to Aron. So it was not about storytelling at all, but about functions. So he tried to separate the ethos of the state from the functions that the states are trying to address in everyday life. And so he suggested that the global conditions of life that the book is talking about require that some of the functions of the state would be transformed and transferred to a different dimension of politics that could be supranational organizations or regional organizations. And in a sense, this set the ground for thinking about the European Union. So his idea of functionalism was very influential in setting up the kind of economic agreements that were the nucleus of the European Union. So I tried to compare in this chapter these two visions of how the nation state can survive in a global order. And then I used the ideas of E.H. Carr to show that the differences between Michirani and Aron were not simply differences based on practical solutions. So it was not just policy, but it was really the differences were grounded in their different conceptions of politics, which for Aron was based necessarily on conflict. And like E.H. Carr, he had a very realist idea of what politics was about. And he thought that conflict could not be avoided, even if we construct this world order that would be global and collaborative and so on, conflict would always be there. And so a political myth could help to reduce it. But E.H. Carr helped to think about the limits of the non-political approach of Michirani, that was E.H. Carr was similarly supportive of Michirani's idea of functionalism, but he doubted that it would ever be possible to reduce the passions and the tensions that are part of political life.
Excellent. So we'll move on to the next chapter. And something that you do like throughout the book that I think is really wonderful is how you bring together this eclectic assortment of intellectuals, many of whom you don't necessarily think about together, but they were all sort of talking about similar objects. So in this chapter, chapter three, geopolitics and regional order, it really comes out because you trace the discussion of regions and world order through the geopolitical thinking of Nicholas Spickman and Owen Lattimore. And I found it really interesting because I had personally always really thought about Owen Lattimore in the context of the McCarthyist witch hunts, and I had kind of overlooked his intellectual contributions. So I really enjoyed thinking about that. So can you tell listeners about this story of geopolitics, its relationship to empire, which I found really interesting in this chapter, and what these scholars had to say about world order.
Yes, so I'm very glad that you say that about Lattimore, first of all, because I ran across his writings when I did my master's in Oxford, and especially on the notion of the frontier, which seemed to me very elusive but interesting. And I learned afterwards that indeed he was excluded from the history of political thought, if you want, in the U.S. because of his the campaign that McCarthy had set against him. And this is really, I think, a great pity, because he had very interesting ideas, and also he was very a fascinating person. So I was very happy to be able to read his personal letters as well in the archive and discover his personality. But what matters about him in the context of the chapter is that he was one of the first to address notions of geopolitics beyond the West, and to try to create a geopolitical world order in which the U.S. would retain importance, but China would be given an equal standing. And so he was an expert on China and Mongolia. And in his writings about geopolitics, which were influenced by previous generations of geopoliticians, and I'll talk about it in a minute, he tried to challenge many of the categories of thought in geopolitics, like the land and sea dichotomy or the frontier, and to suggest that these are perhaps tools of imperial domination. And if we want to think of a new global world after the war, we need to resist these. And if we do succeed in resisting this, we'll see that actually Asia can become a new block of freedom, a new regional order where democracy could emerge as a powerful alternative to both capitalism and collectivism, as he called it, so both the U.S. and the Soviet Union. So I was interested in seeing today we're very accustomed to people foreseeing the rise of China as a rising power and a global democracy and so on. I mean, democracy perhaps up to a certain point. But I was interested in seeing why in the 1940s he thought this would be the case. And then I had to really position his thought within the context of geopolitics in the United States at the time to understand why Lattimore was making these arguments. And in the U.S., geopolitics was not necessarily a major field, because many of the people who were concerned with these themes, with the relations between geography and politics, were afraid of being associated with the German geopolitik, the kind of expansionist ideology that helped the Nazi regime to justify its military aggressiveness. And so in the US, you have these various scholars like Azar Bauman others as well, who were like Nicholas Spykman, who were trying to provide geopolitical analysis without necessarily defining it as geopolitics. And so they have created, Azar Bauman created around him a group of scholars like Hans Weigert and Stephenson, who were producing really groundbreaking geopolitical studies. And in that context, Spykman emerged as this kind of great strategist who were trying to imagine the future of the world in geopolitical terms. And he imagined this tripolar order in which the United States would be one power pole, Soviet Russia another, and Britain, the British Empire, would be the third power pole. And this contrasted really nicely with what Owen Latimore proposed. So for him, the world would also be a tripolar system, but it would be based on the United States, Soviet Russia, and China. So no longer Europe. He turns away from Europe and focuses on Asia as this new region of democracy that for him could transform the world. And so for me, this contrast was very interesting because it was not only about who would be the third power pole, but it was also about what kind of role the United States could play in that transformation. So, because for Spykman, this the idea that the tripolar order would be important in the post-World War depended on the permanence of empire. For him, the British Empire and the United States, which would be a new kind of empire, could only resist the USSR and its rise to global dominance. So there was an attempt here to stop the power of evil, if you want. While for Latimore, geopolitics was all about liberation. So for him, the rise of Asia would mean the end of empire and the rise of a new kind of democracy that would be defined in grassroots terms. And so for me, this was interesting because it showed that geopolitics was a multifaceted discipline in the United States in the 40s. A lot of it was lost afterwards because after the 40s, the study of international relations in the U.S. turned away from geopolitics towards other concerns. And perhaps also in the Cold War, these ideas were no longer appealing to scholars in the U.S. who had other concerns. And so it seems to me that the 40s really distill this moment when geopolitics was important for explaining the relations between the global and the local level of politics.
Excellent. The next two chapters I found really also interesting. I mean, I found the whole book interesting, but the next two chapters I found really interesting, particularly as an Americanist, largely ignorant of the Federal Union. So it was wonderful to learn about it and also see all these really interesting intellectuals really thinking about the world and the world order. So you write that global... So the Federal Union is this British organization that really tries to promote this global democratic federalism. And you write that it begins as a way to preserve the imperial order, but then it eventually morphs into a tool of socioeconomic reform. So can you please tell listeners about the Federal Union, some of its individuals, like maybe William Beveridge or Barbara Wooten, and what they meant when they said democratic federalism, and also what were some of the conceptual and geographic boundaries of their theories and ideas of democratic federalism?
Right. So what I'm trying to do in these two chapters is, first of all, to show that Federal Union as a political organization that had massive success when it was founded in 1938 in London, it did not come out of the blue. So the idea of a federation was already there before federal union. However, what's important about federal union is that it managed to transform this idea, as you said, from the imperial realm into a democratic proposal for socioeconomic welfare. And how did that come about? So essentially, this organization was funded in 1938 when three Oxbridge graduates sat in a pub in London, as the legend goes, and they thought that soon war would take over Europe, and so something must be done to prevent that. And the solution was for them the Union of Britain and any other democratic state that would like to join that federation to resist the threat of war that came from Germany. And so it started off as this call for unity. But this is the less interesting aspect, in my view, because what I was interested in is to understand what kind of federation these people were calling for and what kind of political ideas were standing behind that. And so you see that initially their organization invited also people like Lionel Curtis to participate in the discussions and in the meetings. And Lionel Curtis is quite well known to British historians because he's an Oxford scholar who campaigned since the early 20th century in favor of transforming the British Empire into a federation in which the dominions, as they used to be called, and some of the colonies would become active participants in a Commonwealth of Nations, as he called it. And his was really almost a theological, messianic idea of federal polity in which the spirit of Britain would inspire democracy in all these other places of the world, from Australia to Canada to South Africa, Ireland, etc. And so this was his idea that, was not really given any practical policymaking aspect, but it did gain a lot of support in certain circles. And Lionel Curtis was also one of the founders of the Chatham House, which is an important international relations think tank in London that provided a lot of policy guidance and still does. And so he did have a listening ear in the establishment. However, as it happened, and as I tried to show in these two chapters, his ideas were not really well received in federal union because they seemed antiquated. They seemed a relic of the past, and federal union did not really want to perpetuate empire. Actually, in many of their publications, they were talking against empire, against the legacy of colonialism, and in favor of creating a system where colonies could participate actively as equal members rather than as lower or less important parts of the federation. And so I think what really matters was that federal union managed to attract a group of economists who were really at the cutting edge of research in economics in London at the time. And this included William Beveridge from the LSE, who then moved to Oxford, Lionel Robbins, Barbara Wooten, who was one of the first women economists, and then she moved to sociology, but she's a groundbreaking women thinker in Britain at the time, and Friedrich Hayek, who soon afterwards moved to Chicago and became famous. But back in the day in the LSE, he was not really well known. So this was before he published The Road to Serfdom as well. And so the discussions in federal union revolved around what kind of federal democracy they should offer. And what's interesting for me is that the debate between Wooten and Hayek revolved around the idea of planning and welfare and what kind of political and economic principles could provide the best solution for a prosperous federation. And so they thought that both of them agreed that a federation would provide better conditions to achieve wealth, to achieve growth, to improve the living conditions of people beyond the boundaries of the nation state. However, they had completely different ideas of how this should be done. And there were intense discussions about that in Federal Union. And so succinctly, Hayek thought that the federation would help to reduce the power of the state and to create a minimalist political organization where individuals would be free to pursue their own ambitions, economic ambitions in the free market. And so federation was useful for breaking the borders of the nation states and creating a free space where people and goods could circulate without limits. And so he was obviously against protectionism and against planning. Although he agreed that a degree of social planning could be implemented on a local level by a community. So, for example, in a little village, they could decide that they would have free housing if they wanted to. So that was not excluded in his view. Later on, he criticized even this kind of planning. Barbara Wooten, on the other hand, had a much more expansive idea of what the federation should do. So for her, a federation was useful because it created a larger geopolitical space for planning. She thought that by pulling together resources and manpower and economic goods and in industries, it was possible to plan better economies and to create better and more prosperous societies. And so the federation would basically prevent the limitations that states have because they lack some resources or because they don't have cheap manpower and so on. And they would create a more easy way of setting up the conditions for growth. And so they, Wooten and Hayek, really show the two extremely different perceptions of what a democratic federation could be. And what's interesting, and I try to reflect on that in the chapter as well, is that both of them were inspired in a sense by Lionel Robbins, who was also a London-based economist at the LSE. And he had started to write about these issues of federalism and economics back in 1937. And then for him, this was an idea that could help to prevent war, naturally, but also to bring greater prospect of growth on an economic level. And so both Hayek and Wooten were inspired by Robbins, but they took his ideas to completely different directions. And so at Federal Union, they provided the platform for discussion on all of these ideas. And I think this is really the interesting contribution of this organization rather than perhaps its actual policy achievements. What happened is that during the war, all of these people were recruited for war service. And so they eventually abandoned the organization, which still continues to exist if you want to sign up. In London. And so the story is really about how they were planning the post-war era, but it's impossible to follow through because many of these people have left it before the war had ended. However, I think they really give us some interesting reflections on the problems of the economy of the European Union today and the kind of political challenges that this aspect of federation brings.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, so I mean, I really hope the current iteration of the Federal Union isn't trying to preserve empire, it's nice to know that they're still around. You move on to another globalist project, this one located in the United States in Chapter 6. And this is the attempt to draft a world constitution at the University of Chicago. And it was a group of intellectuals led namely by Robert Hutchins who were responding to this crisis of the world order and as well the atomic bomb and wanted to draft a constitution to restore order, to create a new order. And you at one point cite Mark Mazower, who dismisses this in hilarious prose. He dismisses it as a staggeringly implausible document. But you show that this document and the process in creating this document was actually very historically significant, especially as it relates to, or as they relate to globalism. So what did these intellectuals envision, and did they truly believe that this constitution would change the world?
So, yes, the book, in the context of the book, it the chapters develop on the basis of scale. And so now we arrive at the world scale, from the state to the region, the empire, now finally the world. And as you said, this project of the world constitution draft was really laughed at by later historians, so ridiculed for the high degree of impracticality, if I may use not as extreme tone as... but in a sense, I think, well, as far this is obviously correct because it was not really put in practice, but I think this is a wrong approach, because what's interesting about this committee is not really the final draft they were able to produce, but rather the discussions that they had about what it means to think about world order in global terms, and why they thought their constitution would be a solution to the world's problems. And just to expand on what you said, so this Constitution Committee included some 15 of the leading scholars of the University of Chicago and other universities in the States. And these people dedicated 2 years of their lives on frequent weekend-long meetings to think very hard about these topics. So it was not something they did offhand, mm-hmm. and it was not. And it's difficult to imagine nowadays a group of leading Harvard or Chicago intellectuals who would do such a project. So some of them were quite famous, including at the time at least, including Richard McKeon, the philosopher, Mortimer Adler, the Catholic philosopher. Charles Howard McEwen from Harvard, James Landis, Robert Redfield, Rexford Tugwell, Reinhold Niebuhr at a certain point was part of that group, Wilbur Katz and William Hawking. So these were quite influential and leading intellectuals. Now, why did they want to do that? Essentially, they thought that the war, and especially the atomic bomb, created not only a threat of destruction, but also an opportunity to change politics at the root. And they thought that the solution to that would have to be based on law. And in that sense, they decided to write this constitution. And what's interesting is that the discussions around the constitution really revolved around two main approaches. So the one was the expansive maximalist approach to the constitution that was advanced by Giuseppe Borghese, who was an anti-fascist Italian literary critic, and he was married to the daughter of Thomas Mann, who was also part of that group. Hmm. And so he thought that it was time to really put in the democratic ethos in the world, and at the same time also create this constitution that would accept pluralism and bring about justice to the world as a whole. Because I think many of these intellectuals who were involved in that project, and including him, were at the time already beyond conscription age. They couldn't really participate in the world, in the war effort. And they were kind of, you know, spending the time in the campus looking at what was going on in the battlefield far away and feeling a bit perhaps helpless. And so they decided to dedicate themselves to finding an intellectual solution for that challenge of war. What's interesting, I think, is the way that they theorized some key ideas that today are very important for political philosophers and global constitutionalists, like the problem of human rights, the problem of sovereignty as a united or divided concept, whether it's possible to share sovereignty with the state and with supranational organizations, and the problem of representation, how it is possible to find a way to represent the political will of people around the world without recreating the same kind of national tensions that brought to the war. And so they really created a vast documentation that can be found today in the University of Chicago on the problems that arise from these issues. And what's new here as well is a degree of concern with a non-Western world. So unlike the previous chapters here, there is really an awareness of their own bias as Westerners, and a need to address the will and the, original and independent political hopes of the non-Western world after the war. And so many of them thought that it would be good to include in that project also non-Western representatives. But this was logistically impossible. And so what they did was to bring in to their research group copies of the constitutions of many countries that were liberated from the imperial yoke and were writing their constitutions at the time. And that included Ceylon and Israel, as well as, Japan was not colonial, but it still saw itself as a new democratic power in the region. And so they were trying to learn from other people's experience as well. However, at the end, the battle between the maximalist vision of the constitution that Borghese advanced, as I suggested, and the more minimalist idea of the constitution that was advanced by Richard McKeon, who was a philosopher in Chicago and hoped to create a very vague and inclusive document that would be similar perhaps to the Declaration of Universal Declaration of Human Rights that actually was published afterwards. This clash between the opinions was not doing the committee very good, and they ended up adopting the more ambitious plan. However, this brought to them mixed reactions. So they were, on the one hand, celebrated for their achievement as an intellectual aim, but also were attacked for the lack of political practicality. Important people reacted to that constitution, including the jurist Hans Kelsen, who wrote very interesting comments on that. But I think that in the book, I try to explain why they chose that ambitious project that they knew really deep inside that could not be realized. And it seems to me that the reason was the rejection of the nuclear arms control plan by the Soviet Union in 1947. And so this was a major event at the time, although nowadays we're not really, we don't really consider that as a massive turning point. But what happened was that the United States prepared this plan for international control of nuclear weapons, and it was advanced by both scientists and politicians. However, it was rejected in the UN by the Russian representatives. And so this showed to the committee members, the constitutionalists, that there could be no agreement with Russia on international matters. And so they suggested that their constitution would remain an intellectual product. It could not be implemented at the time. And in that sense, obviously, the opponents or the later historians as well were right, because the constitution did not have concrete realization. However, I think it left a mark. And people like Richard McKeon, but also Jacques Maritain, who read it and were inspired by it, considered it as an encouragement for thinking about human rights as a global entitlement. And so I'm interested in this constitution really as a stone on the way for global thinking, not necessarily as a political project that we should realize.
Excellent, thank you. So the next chapter, Perceptions of Science and Global Order, looks at a group of intellectuals who perceived morality and science to be global phenomena, that the post-war global order would intertwine scientific universalism and moral universalism. But as you showed, this had the effect of actually restricting diversity within the global order. So we'll unfortunately have to take this chapter and the next chapter a little bit more briefly so that we have time to chat about the conclusion. So what in this chapter, chapter 7, did you find most interesting and would like to share with the listeners?
So in this chapter, I was surprised really to see how these thinkers who are so concerned with the problems of science, especially in light of the importance they gave to liberty, how easily they reverted to ideas like faith and belief. And so it helps for me to show that on thinking about what really unites the world globally, we usually come to think about science and technology as something that breaks borders. But actually, for these thinkers, faith and belief were also, in a sense, universal. If we challenge this idea that faith and belief are universal and actually ground them in a Western experience, then perhaps similar ideas can be said about science. So in this chapter, I'm trying to challenge and to see how the interaction between faith and science, as you said, is not really about a universal perception, but more about the expansion of the West and its experience.
Great. You end the science chapter with a really interesting segue and show how a lot of these thinkers grounded their belief in scientific universalism in Christianity. So then that leads to chapter 8, Catholicism, Pluralism, and Global Democracy. And here you trace a really, maybe this shows more of my ignorance than what the historiography says, but a seemingly forgotten strain of Catholic theology that oriented itself to the globe and to ideas of world order. So again, from this chapter, what are some of the really interesting things that you would like to share with the listeners?
Right. So this chapter really started for me from the concern, as you said in the previous chapter, with the universality of Christianity that a lot of 1940s people had. And naturally, Catholicism is a religion that defined itself by its universality. And so Jacques Maritain and Luigi Sturzo, who are the protagonists of this story, were both exiled, however, in the United States. However, both of them were trying really hard to think about the post-war world in terms that would be global. And what's interesting in this for me is the role of democracy and pluralism in their thought. And so in this comparison, I mean, nowadays, Jacques Maritain has been revived in a way by Samuel Moyne and others as this thinker of human rights, or perhaps a person who limits our perception of human rights through his very Catholic reading of them. And so he left this kind of legacy that many people are unaware of. For Moyne, at least. But what I was interested in the comparison with Sturzo is actually to show the variety of Catholic thinking at the time and to show that we should be more attentive than to just dismiss that as kind of conservative. So Sturzo used similar categories as Maritain, like human rights and the person, human person, to think about a new world order. But for him, this would have to be based on democracy. So he gave a much greater weight to the idea of democracy, as well as to a degree of pluralism and diversity that had to be embraced even by the Catholics. So even if the Catholics knew in their hearts that they were right and their idea was universally true, they still had to support a pluralist order for Sturzo. Sorry. And this idea really we don't see so much in Maritain. And so I was interested in that contrast to perhaps enrich our understanding of some of the nuances of religious thought about globalism in that period.
Great. So on to the conclusion. One thing that I was really struck by in the conclusion was how you explain how you're not only tracing globalist ideas, but you're also historicizing the mid-century role of public intellectuals. And your book actually offers a really fascinating reflection on the arrival of the global public intellectual, as most of your intellectuals were global citizens, some were emigres, and all were really oriented to the globe. So why should historians pay more attention to public intellectuals? And what does your book say about the changing role of the public intellectual? And a question that was kind of lingering for me at the end of the book was, who were their publics?
Right. Well, these are terrific questions, sometimes a bit difficult to answer. So initially, I was just very curious to think about what kind of public role these public intellectual could have. Because what's interesting for me is that all of these people really saw themselves as public intellectuals, which means as scholars who had important engagement or gave important weight to their engagement with the public. And this public was not necessarily well-defined. So sometimes it was just the readers of daily newspapers where they published their op-eds. Other times it was more specific readers of magazines that were thematic about world politics or about law and so on. But there was always an ambition to reach beyond academia, to reach the wider population of people who were interested, but not necessarily had all the information. And so I think really the 1940s was a time when the discourse for these intellectuals was not really restrained to the elite anymore. They realized that they really need to communicate with the people. And the people apparently were also interested in these debates. And so I think that the democratization of public discourse obviously did not happen in one day. But I think in the 1940s, we see that pretty strongly. And this is also reflected, for example, in President Roosevelt's attempts to address the citizens directly through radio programs. And so there was a growing awareness of the need to really reach out and to really explain and express ideas in a clear way so that people could be persuaded, because democratic consent was increasingly important. And so this is, in a way, the main reason I was looking at public intellectuals, because they thought that the public was important. And so I was curious to know why. And I think in the book I try to show that all of the work was really aimed at explaining to the public why they had certain ideas and justifying these ideas in a convincing way, which I think is something that perhaps is something that we can take today as well. Something that scholars or people who have particular knowledge or particular interest in certain aspects of life could take as well today, of the need to share these ideas and to perhaps confront a general public as well as the experts around us.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why we do podcasts.
Yeah.
So I have one final question about the book, and it has to do with the limits of globalism, and particularly in regards to colonies or the global South or the non-West. So what were these conceptual and geographic blind spots, and what does it say about globalism that so many of these thinkers had these blind spots?
So I really think the blind spots of these thinkers were huge. I don't think many of them had the awareness that we have today of how big their limits really are. Some of them, like Owen Latimore, who thought concretely about Asia and was informed of what was going on in Asia, were an exception. And so I think that the discourse of globalism is not, in a sense, a global discourse. It's a Western discourse, and I'd be curious to know more about whether and how people in other parts of the world thought about world order at that time. And so I'm not really pretending that this can be a conclusive or a world-spanning intellectual history. This is more of a glimpse into the way that Westerners thought about the globe. And I think it shows very well the limits of globalism and perhaps globalization thinking that we still have today. And so, for example, the perception that the globe can really be an extension of Western civilization was still pretty strong in the 1940s. And this is a risk that today all those people who are doing global history or global politics are still in danger of doing. So this is something that we should be aware of today as well. But the 1940s thinkers were definitely besieged with these problems. And we should, and I'm trying in the book also to flag them. So we're not, this is not supposed to be kind of teleological or a celebratory account of globalism.
Great. Well, thank you. So the final question that we always ask our guests on the show is, what are you working on right now?
So now we have this new project about imperialism before the First World War, and I look specifically at the Italian experience of liberal imperialism and why Italy decided to embark on a liberal empire and how it was informed. This project was informed by Italian conceptions of world order. So I'm moving a little bit away from the Anglosphere and towards the Mediterranean.
Perfect. Well, I really look forward to reading it. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. And hopefully we'll chat again. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.